The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Vulnerabilities. Or use backdoors in software, or compel companies or organizations to insert backdoors in their software, which are intentionally then kept hidden from users. Moreover, oftentimes the operational sort of requirements of electronic search and seizure require new laws or new regulations or new initiatives that essentially compel assistance from third-party software and communications providers. When these tools are embedded in free software, it might become virtually impossible for users to understand how their software works, let alone to modify it. And when mass surveillance is prevalent, and specifically when it is scoped by very broad and very vague restrictions on the development and use and sharing and modification of code, developers and researchers and users may be afraid to tinker with the code, fearing that their modifications could attract unwanted attention from the authorities. The result, of course, stifles innovation and discourages collaborative innovation. And as individuals become less inclined to contribute to projects that might raise suspicions either about themselves or their organizations. Third freedom, which is the right to redistribute copies, is also undermined by mass surveillance. So for instance, when sharing of software is monitored, users might become hesitant to share their work, their own modified work, fearing legal repercussions. In other cases where users are aware that there might be surveillance tools embedded within software, they might become hesitant to share it in the first instance. This may lead to chilling effects on the distribution and sharing of free software and modified software as people fear the consequences of inadvertently spreading tools of surveillance. And then finally, mass surveillance poses a threat to the fourth freedom, which is freedom three, the right to improve on a program and release your improvements to the public. So users who attempt to make improvements might find themselves unable to do so without potentially exposing themselves to further risk. For instance, improvements to code might be perceived as a threat by those who conduct mass surveillance, especially where those improvements are security or privacy improvements or features. This could lead then to potential retaliation against the individuals who seek to advance the software. So to sum up basically the point, which is mass surveillance undermines the four freedoms of software. Mass surveillance is a significant threat because it stifles creativity, deters collaboration, restricts the flow of knowledge that is fundamental and essential to the success and growth of free software. As supporters of free software, we have to be vigilant in our fight against mass surveillance, and we have to advocate for privacy and civil liberties in a manner that promotes transparency and accountability within our digital landscape. So at NIM Technologies, we tackle this issue right at the root of mass surveillance, and that is specifically the network layer. The network layer, if you can look at the stack of communications as something that in a very reductive way separates into or is comprised of these five layers: hardware, the operating system, the network, and then the protocol sitting on top of the network, and then the application. The NIM network essentially tackles the network layer and works against electronic surveillance or mass surveillance, where the purpose or target or outcome of the surveillance is to collect metadata, which is essentially information about who you're talking to, where you are, and other sort of information about your communications. The reason that mass surveillance exists, by the way, and exists at very low cost is because the internet is broken. And specifically, rather than get into the details of how the internet is broken, because that could take us a week, right, I'm going to throw up a cool chart that I made a few years ago to demonstrate how potentially a mass surveillance regime might work. And this is vaguely modeled over the United States and global mass surveillance conducted by the United States. So here, if I had a pointer, I would point, but I don't. Here you have the internet backbone, this yellow sort of block over here, right? And you could think of the internet backbone as containing all of the data that flows in underwater fiber cables, right? And about 80% of that backbone, or the data that flows through that backbone, flows through cables that the United States has, that a country, for example, the United States, might have jurisdiction over. In other words, 80% of that internet backbone is basically owned by, owned with a zero by the country conducting mass surveillance. The other 20% is extraterritorial, or outside of the jurisdictional sort of coffers of the state. In our case, at least very roughly, we have about 80% control. The 20% that's left over is mostly controlled by allies such as the UK, predominantly, and to a lesser extent, Japan, maybe like Denmark and France, countries like that, but really it's predominantly the UK. And so from that, several regimes of mass surveillance sort of trickle down. So the first is all the way on the right. That would be a program like Upstream. That's programmatic surveillance or programmatic collection of data, where essentially if you imagine, well, let's talk about packets, right? So if you imagine a message going from point A to point B, the way internet works is that that message has to be divided into packets, and those packets go from source to destination using efficient routes, not routes that evade surveillance, right? And those efficient routes basically mean that you're jumbling these communications and mixing them, and you have no real guarantee which route they're going to take. So if you are a nation state that wishes to capture this information, right, and decode or target one piece of information, what you have to do is collect everything, right? And this is sort of the beginning of this idea that in order to find the needle, you need the whole haystack, right? And so the government, or at least the United States government, through programs like Upstream, can collect all information, or roughly 80% of information that is, of course, not decrypted and not, it's very, very messy type of information that then gets stored and decrypted and then selected for longer term storage based on certain keywords, etc. But the point is that mass surveillance, and specifically metadata surveillance, accounts for a very big, if not the vast majority of what electronic surveillance regimes actually collect. I can get back to this diagram towards the end of the talk if there's time, because you know we started a little late. But of course there are other programs that deliver metadata to the government, such as just direct subpoena service, or National Security Subpoena Service to US ISPs or US telephone service providers. And of course, obviously, for all the foreign data, the data that's outside of the jurisdiction, you're looking to either diplomatic ties to get that information through cross-border collaboration, much of which is informal, frankly, or just offensive measures to grab the data from not necessarily adversaries, but allies as well. So what does all this have to do with NIM and why am I here? The reason I'm here is that no existing solution, at least until the NIM mixnet, can defend against NSA and private company surveillance. What I mean by NSA and private company surveillance is very sophisticated actors, like nation state level. But as we know, because as the sort of performance of computers increases, the designation of sophisticated adversary and nation state is no longer one and the same, right? So we have private actors. Well, first of all, it's not just the United States that can conduct nation state level sophisticated adversarial attacks that I'm about to describe, but it's also private corporations that might be thought of as non-sovereigns. So basically, metadata leaks at the network level, even with encrypted messages, like using Signal. So you guys might send a Signal message to somebody else thinking that the content is encrypted, and that means that the communication, as well as the time of the communication, who you're talking to, et cetera, is also kept private, but that is not the case. And this is also in the case of, for example, Zcash, which is a private cryptocurrency. If you transfer Zcash over regular network, there will be metadata leaks, and that can be used then to trace the transaction, whether that's a message or a financial transaction, a file, et cetera. So the current solutions, are either a centralized VPN. A centralized VPN, which I'm sure at least 90% of this room uses or has used at some point, I would posit does not actually offer privacy. What it does is move your trust to the centralized VPN provider. And that can then be exploited, whether through a security exploit, but also through the government, right? And very simple subpoena access could get information about your account. Then we have Tor, of course, and the Tor browser and the Tor network does not provide anonymity against adversaries that can monitor the whole network. And this is something that the Snowden revelations kind of showed to the world. There are two specific attacks that tend to undermine the complete privacy that we thought Tor provided over networks. And I'll show exactly how that works in just a moment. So how does NIM sort of get over these obstacles? First, traffic is routed through, traffic is routed through multiple nodes to unlink the origin and destination IP addresses, similar to Tor. Second, and this is a truly kind of like the innovation of a mixnet, is that it prevents traffic analysis by adding cover traffic. What is cover traffic? It's dummy traffic. It's noise. Essentially what it does is make every packet that leaves the mixnet look one and the same to a casual or to an outside observer, because they are timed exactly the same in terms of timing between packets, and they are the same exact size. In addition, what that does, so I said two things, right? They're all the same exact size due to cover traffic, but they also obfuscate the timing. So the timing of the packets that leave is all one and the same, and the volume of the data that leaves is consistent throughout. And so that is a second difference with Tor. The other cool thing about the mixnet is that it can expand or scale horizontally for more traffic by
adding nodes in a dynamic sort of way. Here's a diagram that just described the very inarticulate explanation that I gave, right? So you might have a VPN, right? And a VPN, you're putting all your trust in the VPN's servers, right? Tor decentralizes that component, the computing component, right? And so you're not putting all your trust into one party, right? What does that mean? Why is that important? The reason that's important is because in the first sort of level here, law enforcement can subpoena the VPN provider for your data. It's a subpoena based on relevance. What's relevant to an investigation? Everything. Do I care about you being guilty? That's relevant. That's actually relevant to an investigation, by the way. With no judicial oversight, that's what you get from a VPN provider. So essentially, you're trusting the VPN provider to either work around that through their policies or through their tech. And you're taking their word for whatever they tell you, right? With Tor, they actually decentralize that. But there are two issues with the actual protocol of Tor, which is that packets can be de-anonymized by very sophisticated actors that can either do timing attacks or size attacks by doing correlative analytics based on the size and timing of packets entering and exiting the network. Of course, NIM, as I tried to explain, changes that or modifies or actually gets around those vulnerabilities by inserting the dummy traffic and also by ensuring that the anonymized packets leaving the network will leave with equidistant timing to one another. Cool, so how does this all work? There are different scenarios that developers can integrate NIM into their software. One is a WebSockets client, and basically a standalone binary on your desktop or server machine. You can always compile it yourself, and you can do it basically use that code to do a native integration within your code base. There's a WebAssembly client, which is useful for browser applications, and it's packaged via NPM for import into TypeScript and JavaScript applications. And then what I'm going to demonstrate today is the SOX 5 client, which is useful for allowing existing applications to use the MixNet without any code changes. So can Signal run over a SOX 5 proxy? If the answer is yes, then you can run it over NIM Connect if there is a server that is set to either Signal or that's an open proxy. Basically, this is very similar to the to Tor in that it integrates with anything that Tor can because it's a similar way that Tor integrates through SOX 5. All right. So the SOX 5 client, cool. Any application that has support for SOX 5, for instance, Signal, IRC, Telegram, crypto wallets, email clients, and so on, the way it works is that you send traffic to your local NIM SOX 5 client, and that takes care of the proxying through the MixNet. What do I mean? What I'm going to show you is NIM Connect, which is the local client that NIM has developed. And the packets, essentially what NIM Connect will do is it will connect to, well, I'll show you, I'll describe that when I do the demo. So the SOX 5 client instance is a binary that essentially accepts application traffic and sends the traffic to a network requester or the other side of the MixNet. On the other side of the MixNet, and the network requester runs alongside the NIM client on a VPS, and it allows for private network requests to be made either outside the MixNet from your desktop machine. It is not an open proxy. It's sort of like a Tor exit node, if you were to sort of to compare. Okay, so here, licensing. So we at NIM, have four core components licensed using GPL3 and AGPL 2.0. Because integration with outside developers is important, because anonymity without company doesn't equal anonymity. What do I mean by that? If everybody in this room basically is on a network, we are the only people on that network, and it's an anonymized network, then it's not really going to do much because we've narrowed it down to the 50 people in this room, right? So for the same reason that Tor opened itself up to the world when it was exclusively a military application or protocol, right? At some point, they had to have this conversation. Like, okay, well, everything's gonna be attributed to the US military. That kind of sucks. Let's just open it up to the world, right? And so for us, we need the developers to come in, and we need more users so that the network can become truly anonymized in that way. And I would note that before I joined as general counsel, that is when we had these Apache licenses. Okay, so since joining, we've only done GPL licenses, and I'm just saying that because I'm having some throat issues, and I really won't be able to get into huge arguments today, I promise. Okay, so we can meet outside later. Okay, so shall we run a demo? One thing about NIM Technologies is we have the coolest community ever. This demo that I'm about to show you is basically an IRC client running over the NIM network. I use the LimeChat IRC client and a SOX 5 proxy configuration using NIM Connect, the local client, and a service provider that was provided to us by a member of our community called No Trust Verify that is in open proxy mode until the end of this demo. So anybody in the world could run on this service provider if they had the very long ID that I will keep secret for the next 20 minutes. Okay, so let's see if I can run this video and see what happens. Can we run the video? Okay, where is it though? That's the question.
Did you run it?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Oh. That's it right there. Okay, yeah, sounds good. All right. So here, that is NIM Connect up top on the top right. I'm going to settings, and I'm inserting the address of the service provider that's kept on open proxy. It is connected with the service provider and given me a SOX 5 address and a port. I then go to LimeChat and properties, trying to connect to the Libera IRC chat. And I'll go into details and set SOX 5 proxy and the IP address that was provided by NIM Connect. And then here, I connect to there you go. Okay, so here I connect to the NIM chat room, hashtag NIM. And the IP address, that is unfortunately in gray, but what I will do is post a better, more visibly a better demo online where you can actually see this IP. But yeah, that's the exciting demo, right? But the reality is if this IP matches the IP address of the server that we set over here in NIM Connect, and it does not, it does not match the IP address of where I was located, which is in my house at the time a couple days ago. So this is a demo, again, prepared by No Trust Verify, who we love.
And I would actually note that it took them about half an hour. Basically, I just stuck something in a chat like, I'm doing a talk in 2 days. Can someone help me out by providing an IRC demo? And it was just done, voila. So thanks, No Trust Verify, and the rest of the NIM community. Here, or are we out of time? Wonderful. Okay, well, yes. Thanks, No Trust Verify, because they're the best ever, right? And just a sort of breakdown of how this communication would have transpired, right? Here you have the person, right? Or the source is our little video game character here, right? And you have the NIM local client on the machine, right? This is NIM Connect. And NIM Connect takes care of creating the MixNet traffic, right? And forgive me, sorry, I can't really read that, right? And then so the Sphinx packets that come out of the NIM Connect, so Sphinx packets that come out of the NIM local client are all the same size before being sent to the internet. They are anonymized and won't reveal timing or other metadata. And so the receiving network requester speaks to a service on a server or does a P2P broadcast on the open internet if necessary. So once again, the creepy chart of the type of surveillance that we're trying to avoid right now is metadata surveillance, and that includes communications captured on from the internet backbone through programs like Upstream. Authorities like the FISA Amendments Act 702, which by the way is set for renewal any day now, as well as metadata collection by Patriot Act Section 215, the infamous 215 telephony metadata warrants that came out post Snowden disclosures. And any other type of actual individualized warrant that seeks to capture information about a transaction. Again, my name is Ahmed Gapoor. I'm General Counsel at NIM Technologies, and thank you for listening. Oh, cool, okay. All right, let's do Q&A. Yes. Oh, cool, yeah.
Hey, thank you very much for your talk. Very interesting stuff. I'm excited to try it myself. So one of the main issues with mixed networks is that if you're the only one on a network using them, then you're known to be using the technology, right? And in certain places where you stand out, that's going to be a big problem. Does NIM have plans for bridging or like a project like Snowflake Proxy for Tor where it basically you're pretending to be normal?
Yes, we have actually, what I can say is that we are dedicating efforts to censorship circumvention, and that would fall under that for us.
Cool.
Generally, yes. Another cool thing about mixnets though, in terms of a cool use case, is if a country, and I don't think Tor is the same way, you can correct me if I'm wrong, if a country decides to cut itself off from the rest of the world, mixed nets actually behave really well in localized environments like that. So if you run a mixed net within that country, it actually provides very good anonymity as compared to other global networks that rely on that type of routing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the issue is like what I said, you don't want to be the Tor person or the mixed net person.
Like the guy at Harvard that used Tor and then got arrested for using, yeah.
Right.
There was, well, he was the one guy on the land that used to work.
Yep, cool, thank you.
Maybe he wasn't arrested, but yes.
Thank you for the talk. A couple of people from IRC said that your slides are great. And there's one question, which is, sorry, I am a complete noob to NIM, hence my question. Since whenever there are such tools, these will be abused by the so-called real bad guys sooner or later. So when opting to run oneself a mix node or gateway for NIM, what is the risk one puts oneself of getting in the scope of authorities, especially from a legal point of view, getting made responsible for what others may do through your node?
So this is, first of all, that's a really, 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 really good question. I will start answering the question by stating that this is not legal advice. So nothing that I say is, well, we'll see. So basically, before joining NIM, before becoming an academic, I worked in human rights, and I also did a bunch of criminal cases. So initially, I was I represented Guantanamo prisoners for a couple of years out of an outfit called Reprieve in the UK. And then I worked with Charles Swift, who was the attorney that did the Hamdan case, Bin Laden's driver. And I've worked on a bunch of national security and espionage and hacking cases. And then I started two clinics to do that in Texas and then in San Francisco. So what is the risk and exposure of running a mixed node? It is the same risk and exposure of running a relay, right? So what is your risk or exposure in running a relay? The TLDR is you might have, you might be annoyed by the authorities, but there is a path to avoiding liability, under my interpretation of the laws and regulations. So what does that mean? That means, you can be harassed by the feds, right? You can be served subpoenas that say, hey, by the way, we need to know everything about this machine, or we would like, you know, the IP logs for this machine. You might say, I don't have any IP logs. And they're like, we need you to start saving some IP logs, right? And by the way, if they issue you a national security letter, if they treat you the way they treated Nicholas Merrill, the founder of Calyx, you guys know Calyx VPN, they might say, well, you're not even allowed to talk to a lawyer about this, right? And you'd have to be like a really brave person. Really brave person to cross the street, walk into the ACLU and be like, you guys, the NSA just served me with this request and says, I cannot share it with a lawyer, right? So the long story short, and I will, it's the same at Gopur. Mastodon, is that you are not exposed in terms of liability, but you may be annoyed, right? That's a fact. So I cannot, I would not recommend, if you don't want to be annoyed by the authorities, to run a relay, an exit node, or a mixnet, sorry, or a mixed node in the United States, simply put.
Thanks for
that's not the technology's fault, by the way. That's our government's fault, just for the record. Okay.
I'm already sold on the idea of the network. I'm sorry I didn't catch how recent this project was, but do you have any estimate or metric on perhaps how many nodes are operating right now, or maybe the size of the network?
Yeah, actually, so our testnet had more nodes than the whole Tor network, and we've increased since then. I don't have an exact number, but we, and then obviously, you know, yeah, so we have a pretty big network. And the cool thing is that, well, mixnets, our mixnet is incentivized. So basically, so I run a relay at home, for instance, a Tor relay. And I run it on a dinky computer, right? The reason I do that is because it's actually costing me money to run it, right? And that's the idea. If you can incentivize that activity, maybe you can get better performance and boost privacy protection.
On that front, could you go into how the implementation of blockchain and the NIM coin to manage your network provides improvements over the current Tor network?
Yeah, so the way, so exactly as I say, right? So there's a big mixnet. The problem with mixnets is they're very resource consumptive, right? And the problem with volunteer networks generally is that they're based on folks that are essentially activists, folks that have no incentive other than their own like moral compass to lend to this global effort to privatize communications, right, or anonymize communications. So what the NIM mixnet does is it incentivizes the mixed nodes to, instead of, like, you might think of it as like mining for Bitcoin, right? Instead of mining for mining Bitcoin, you are mixing traffic, mixing network traffic and being rewarded with a token. So instead of mining Bitcoin and being rewarded with a token, you are mixing traffic and being rewarded with a token. And that is essentially how the NIM token actually is essential to the mixnet. I would note that it is the only registered utility token in Switzerland where we're based, and it was the first registered utility token because it actually does have a utility. And I would also urge folks to read our tokenomics paper, which has been peer reviewed and published in, I think, the MIT Tech Journal or PETS Symposium Journal, Privacy Enhanced Technologies. Thank you very much, everyone. I will be around for more questions.